are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, April 4th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, legendary journalist Mike Hanna, former CNN Jerusalem bureau chief, Al Jazeera correspondent, currently independent presenter and journalist on the Trump-Saudi nuclear deal. Plus, the ongoing fallout of pulling out of the Iran deal and Twitter diplomacy affirming the Israeli occupation of the Golan Heights. All of that with Mike Hanna on today's program. Turns out some members of the Mueller team think that Bob Barr's four-page summary is not doing justice to the full range of the Mueller report. Jared Kushner is identified as the White House official whose security clearance has been denied. House Democrats use an arcane 1920s law to demand Trump's tax returns. They finally did it. Mitch McConnell triggers the nuclear option to speed through more of Trump's nominees. Incredibly disturbing, horrifying report in Harper's that the United States is tracking migrant women's periods to stop them from getting abortions. Okay. DOJ report finds widespread rape, murder, and torture in Alabama prisons. Venezuelan deputy minister says more Russian troops are deploying to Venezuela. And Jair Bolsonaro, at a visit to a Holocaust museum of Benjamin Netanyahu, affirms that the Nazis were leftists in the ongoing fascist alliance emanating from Brazil to Israel. A prominent indigenous rights leader in Brazil has been murdered, and we are approaching the one-year anniversary of the political imprisonment of the man who would have defeated Bolsonaro, Lula da Silva. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. We are here, three-man crew. It's cool. Jamie's lucky with the Ford. She can surface around. I've seen her set her schedule and pick different days at different times, and you're like, wow, just even
Saturdays for Sean. Saturdays are for the boys.
Thursdays are for the boys.
That's every time Jamie says, can I come in on a Thursday? That's what Matt just puts this up on screen and is like, no.
Although I take my I don't have as many 4-day weeks as some of you, but I like to take mine right in the middle of the week. Break it up.
Oh yeah. I would love to have that, one of those you got it nice with that Wednesday off. Brendan and I have to be here 5 days. See, Brendan works the most of any of us, objectively. I actually
love it. We love working.
But I'm here 5 days working. A week. Solo hosting 1 day a week, or main hosting 1 day a week. And then Cedar, Mr. 4-day work week guy, has to be like, oh, you missed days. Oh, Thursday, that's my mental health day. Ridiculous. All right. Oh, wait, we're doing this instead? Okay. Social democracy and basic progressive politics is making the right and the mouthpieces of oligarchs in this country lose their minds so much. that one is tempted to embrace full communism just to see what the psychological fallout for these people would be if we did that. This is Maria Bartiromo and Stuart Varney, you know, having a hissy fit about the idea. Essentially, if we were to create an image, tax policies on oligarchs who have money levels. First of all, billionaires should not exist. Billionaires are fundamentally incompatible with democracy, full stop, including a market democracy, by the way. But any democracy where you took seriously the idea that a broad base of people should be making decisions about their lives, no one could be a billionaire, period. And so we're not even talking about getting rid of billionaires. We're just talking about higher tax rates on capital gains. Essentially, in the image that I always think of, I mean, it literally is just like Mr. Burns taking the lollipop out of the Simpson baby's stroller, right? Like, you're basically just saying, instead of giving people who already have way too much, both economically, politically, and also obviously morally, and just freeing this money up so that people can, like, feed themselves and have heating. This is actually very basic stuff. Listen to how Maria Bartiromo and Stuart Varney talk about this.
Welcome back. Democrats are proposing another tax, this time on capital gains. Joining us now, the host of Varney & Company, Stuart Varney, to weigh in. Good morning, Stu. These taxes are piling up.
Is there any aspect of our financial lives that the government doesn't want to have a piece of? Answer, no. Ron Wyden, Democrat, Senator, Oregon, he proposes that a capital gains tax be levied every year and the tax rate be the same rate as ordinary income. So, if I were to sell my Microsoft, and as I've accumulated my Microsoft over the years, according to this scheme, I would have had to pay a capital gains tax every year, even though I never realized the gain by selling Microsoft. You know, I would have to look at how much money I'd made at the end of the year and pay a capital gains tax on that at the same rate as my ordinary income. I mean, dear Lord. Is there any aspect of our lives that they don't want a big piece of? The answer is no. They want it all. That's what they want. We used to have a differential rate between between work and money. They propose to make it all the same.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Well, at least they're telling us all their plans before 2020.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of people will like those plans. That's
really?
My problem here.
All right. Stu, yeah.
Stuart,
wait, this is wealth confiscation. Say
yes.
It with me. It's wealth
Precisely.
Confiscation, yeah. And Precisely. It's communist.
Yes.
That's
ah!
exactly
you.
What it is.
It's at least a socialist.
For sure. I know you'll have more in 10 minutes, Stu. We'll see you then. Varney Company begins, top of the hour, 9 a.m. Eastern.
Yeah, it's confiscation. That's good. We support that. But I will say, we all remember, even those of us who didn't study the Soviet Union that closely. But I think, you know, if you even just took a few courses, you were very aware of the Stalin's capital gains plan, which was not only central to the Soviet project, that actually set off his second purge, actually. Second Great Purge was Stalin was very angry that members of the Central Committee, Commentariat, were up. They wanted to keep it at a 70% rate, and he was pushing for a 90% rate. Of course, during the Cultural Revolution, we saw the highest capital gains ever when Mao put it to 95%. It was significantly reversed, obviously, under Deng Xiaoping.
I'm not an expert on capital gains taxes, but the way he says they're trying to make money and work taxed at the same rate, like money should be taxed at a higher rate.
Right, that
than
is an
work
incredible
should.
Line, right? You're like, right, exactly, exactly. I mean that, but it is just incredible. I mean, it's not even necessarily socialist. I mean, not to get too pedantic here, but this is just like super basic progressive taxation. And so, like, the projection of radicalism is, as always, just projection, right? I mean, you know, but it's funny to watch them lose their minds over it. Let's give them a lot more to lose their minds about by electing Bernie Sanders president. The Majority Report is supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile app that provides a massive and diverse library.
Sorry.
What was that?
That's just a 21 Savage instrumental.
I
didn't mean to.
On TMBS, where we don't do ads, I would absolutely read a guided meditation ad over a 21 Savage instrumental. But I think on MR, I don't know, you want to put some Cat Stevens under it or something?
I think the copyright
some Ravi Shankar.
So shouldn't do anything about
I think. Okay, all right, let me reset this. The Majority Report is supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile app that provides massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. And the Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. There is a growing body of evidence going, I think, back at least to the 80s with Herbert Benson at Harvard University, who documented something called the relaxation response, down to Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin with his research on MRIs and meditation. Meditation has been reported to increase relaxation, decrease depression. It's good for sleep. It also might help you with pain management as well. There's a plethora of studies about it. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with in life. They have guided meditations for mindfulness, meditations for anxiety, for depression, when you're having trouble falling asleep, meditation for when you're wanting to overcome procrastination or when you're having something important going on at work, and meditations designed for parents. They have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or on your lunch break or when you've just gotten home from work or when you're going to bed. People know that, you know, I not daily, but I have a meditation practice I do. And I mean, it's enormously helpful. I mean, I don't want to sort of, there isn't really much else to say. It absolutely helps you manage, particularly a very stressful and overwhelming life, a lot better and perceive things better. Different people are trying to accomplish different things in meditation, and with Simple Habit, it's able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of their goals, regardless of what their goals are with meditation, how much past experience they have with meditation. So I, as I say, I've had long-term experience in meditation, but I've been using the app to help fall asleep. It's incredibly helpful. I have trouble falling asleep, and it's an excellent way to just slow down and help make that happen. There are a variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit, and that's what sets it apart. Simple Habit just won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Wellbeing App, and it's available on iOS, Android, and web browser. And the Majority Report audience can try it for free by going for a week. Can try it for free for a week by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube, we'll put a link in the video description. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to be right back with Mike Hanna on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Mike Hanna. He's a contributing presenter and reporter for Al Jazeera and is currently present at the United Nations. Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Michael.
There's a little bit of static. You got that? Okay. Mike, there's been a report recently that you actually did. You did a package for Al Jazeera last week that we'll direct people to as well, on this congressional report on the Trump administration's efforts to sell nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia. This hasn't gotten much attention, but it's something that could have significant implications for the political dynamics of the Middle East and security there. What is that story? How is this deal sort of coming into place, and what are the players? Who are the players?
Well, most observers believe there's just been so much corruption within the Trump administration that something like this has flown right under the radar, as you say, and yet it is exceedingly significant. What is exactly going on is that the Energy Department has granted licenses under what is called Part 810, seven licenses to U.S. companies to provide nuclear technology and information to Saudi Arabia. Now, what is weird about this is that this is not the beginning of a process. This process began months, indeed years ago, and it's been part of an ongoing lobbying process by people allied with President Trump and his administration who have launched a campaign to lobby this administration to provide these licenses for businesses. Now, a couple of names involved with this. Michael Flynn, you might remember, a former national security advisor indicted by the special counsel. Tom Barrack, very close friend of Donald Trump, also involved with his campaign. Now, what lies behind this all are a number of U.S. nuclear companies. One of them is called IP3 International, who Michael Flynn worked for as a paid consultant and paid lobbyist with relation to Saudi Arabia before he became national security advisor, while he was national security advisor, and after he was fired as national security advisor. Now, that's not an end to it. Just a few weeks ago, President Trump at the White House held a meeting with nuclear technology companies, U.S., and among them, there we are, we have got IP3 International. So these seven licenses that have been granted at this particular place in what Congress insists is an intention to circumvent its authority is just perhaps the beginning of what is a massive deal between certain U.S. companies and Saudi Arabia in terms of developing Saudi nuclear technology against the clear and expressed wishes of Congress.
And what relate? And so, okay, so it's against the expressed wishes of Congress. Do we have a sense, I guess, first of all, what about the obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and other agreements on controlling this technology are implicated by this deal-making?
Well, let's just take a look at it from the Saudi side. Now, Saudi Arabia, many years ago, signed an SQP. This is a small quantities protocol. Mm-hmm. Now, that says that basically the country does not have significant amounts of nuclear material. Now, that was a long time ago. That particular protocol has been updated. Saudi Arabia has refused to sign the update of that, has refused to sign any deal with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, for inspection of its developing nuclear technology. Now, this is one of the points that members of Congress have brought up, is that Saudi Arabia is not being certified to be capable of dealing with nuclear technology in terms of international conventions. And very pointedly, one of the representatives said to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, while questioning him in a House committee meeting, if you cannot trust a regime with a buzzsaw, then how can you trust it with nuclear technology? Mm. This in reference to the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. So both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, who's actually signed off on these seven agreements, have refused to answer these questions from Congress, repeated questions, the last coming just 2 days ago in a bipartisan letter from a Senate committee asking Perry to explain exactly what lay behind the decision to grant these licenses and why was Congress not consulted.
So why? I mean, is the question. There's obviously the Trump administration, endless allegations and stories of corruption implicating a whole bunch of people. There's the self-interest of companies here in the United States. There's the strategy of Saudi Arabia. And I guess that's in some ways the most, I mean, it's all very disturbing, but we're planning for a post, you know, fossil fuel world, even in our own kind of small way, and we want to look towards this technology? Or is it based on the sort of much more aggressive moves in Saudi foreign policy we've seen the past several years, particularly amplified by this very aggressive leadership of Mohammed bin Salman, a deep paranoia about Iran? Is this a desire for a weapon?
Well, a simple answer to that is a mixture of all of that, Michael. Saudi Arabia is on the record, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is on the record as saying last year that should Iran advance its nuclear capabilities, then Saudi Arabia will obtain nuclear power. He has specifically said that Saudi Arabia wants nuclear ability. Now, we are talking two levels here. One is nuclear power for peaceful purposes. The other is advanced nuclear technology for weaponized a nuclear program. Now, what lies behind this as well is getting back to the big picture, which was the first country that President Trump visited as president? It was Saudi Arabia. Which country has President Trump continued to defend, even though his own intelligence agencies say it was responsible for the murder and dismemberment of a journalist, even though his intelligence agencies say it is carrying out a vicious, unchecked war in Yemen,
right,
even though Congress says it was responsible for the murder of a Saudi journalist and for massive abuse of human rights, even though Congress says it is responsible for an outrageous, cruel, and vicious war in Yemen, yet President Trump chose them as close allies. President Trump continues to protect them, both from Congress and from the reports of his own intelligence agencies. So that is simply a question that I pass out. Why? Secondly, there is an issue here of why were these particular agreements agreed to by the Secretary of Energy? On the face of it, a simple way to circumvent Congress. Now, in terms of Congress's control over U.S. nuclear relations with outside countries, there is a 1-2-3 agreement. Now, this is a protocol by which any business done on a nuclear basis by U.S. companies with foreign entities has to go through Congress. Congress will look at the nature of the deal, will see what safeguards is built into it, and will then issue a 1-2-3 agreement, which will allow U.S. companies and the U.S. government itself to exchange nuclear information and nuclear technology. Now, that does require a clear legislative procedure. What has happened now with these small-term, pump-term agreements is very clearly a bid to circumvent Congress. Congress is well aware of this. It's an issue that Congress is dealing with on a bipartisan level. This incredibly divided Congress comes together on this particular issue with relation to nuclear technology and Saudi Arabia. And of course, as we've just seen on this very day, criticism of Saudi's ongoing war in Yemen and a congressional demand passed by both House and Senate that the U.S. withdraw its support for Saudi Arabia in that operation, which is, all expect, going to lead to the second veto of President Trump's administration. He's going to veto it and send it back to Congress.
And just to spell that out, the United States, along with the United Kingdom, is refueling Saudi jets, supporting logistically, and even in the vote in Congress on pulling the U.S. backing for this war in Yemen, which maybe if you want to, you could get into a little bit more detail into just in terms of just how much of it, frankly, this is just a horrific mass murder of Yemenis and interference in internal politics leading to mass death and devastation. But in fact, even a bill that has actually potentially already been a bit compromised potentially because of something attached in there on intelligence sharing, which needs to be sort of part of pulling out support as well. The Trump administration still would even veto a slightly softened version because they are so committed to being aligned with Saudi Arabia across the board, whether it's the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, mass murder in Yemen, and also just the sort of generally initially the blockade of Qatar and the kind of broader, profoundly reckless steps of the current Saudi leadership.
Yes, I mean, it's very interesting in one level, Michael, that I've spoken to some people connected to the Department of Defense. There has been huge disquiet within the DOD in relation to the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia in that war in Yemen. And very quietly, in fact, the DOD instructed U.S. forces to stop airborne refueling of Saudi fighter aircraft, for example. That no longer happens. The U.S. remains in there as what is described as a consultative service. Department of Defense officials say that the reason for the U.S. being there is to improve Saudi Arabia's targeting, to minimize civilian loss in that ongoing action. Now, that's the official DOD position. But there are many within the DOD, and certainly many in the field, who are exceedingly concerned about the level of risk that the U.S. is putting on itself, supporting an operation that is claiming so many civilian casualties over a long period of time. Now, that is something that Congress has been looking at even before the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. There was great concern in Congress on both sides of the aisle about the ramifications of U.S. support in a war that is claiming mass civilian casualties. Then the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, which concentrated even further the minds of members of Congress, and you had even rabid supporters of President Trump, such as Senator Lindsey Graham, coming out in support of this bill, coming out in opposition to providing support for Saudi Arabia, and in Graham's case, insisting that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi proved once and for all that Saudi Arabia, at every level, not just in terms of supporting it in the war, was not a fit partner for the U.S. in any form. So the level of anger in Congress is intense. The pushback from the Trump administration is massive. As I said, we are going to see in coming days another veto coming out of the Trump administration, another insistence that the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia is more important than acknowledging civilian deaths in Yemen, than acknowledging the murder of a journalist for whom fingers have been pointed at the highest levels in the Saudi government, including the Crown Prince himself. So the question being asked in Congress is, at what stage does the Trump administration stop what would appear to be absolute blind support for this current Saudi regime? And the other question simply is, why does this support continue with this intensity?
Then, of course, this, you know, the stunning juxtaposition of this with the fact that the Trump administration coming into office and pulling out of the Iran deal, which had been steadily confirmed by all objective international agencies, even the United States State Department. There was the side recertification, which the Congress passed, but was not actually part of the Iran deal. But it required essentially the administration in charge to continue to sign off on it once every several months. Well, Rex Tillerson actually did sign off on it in the beginning of the Trump administration because there was simply no evidence from any legitimate body that Iran was in any way deviating from the agreement. They were fulfilling it entirely. Now, there's a whole other set of disagreements and problems with Iran, including different geostrategy in Lebanon or Syria, and of course, absolutely legitimate objections to very serious abuses by the Iranian government of their own people, obviously, from an administration that supports Saudi Arabia to the hilt, that's ludicrous on its face, but nonetheless an entirely valid point when aimed at the Iranian leadership. But how does this juxtaposition of this incredibly reckless move dangerous move to pull out of the Iran deal, first of all, with this sort of push towards, giving Saudi Arabia this capacity. And then secondly, how the rest of the world has been responding, because the Europeans, certainly China, Russia, India, South Africa, they've all been trying to keep this deal in place, which is another sort of major fallout in the Middle East from the Trump era policy.
Yes, well, once again, to look at the broad picture of this, Iran, as you said, may be guilty of certain violations, but one thing that you can be specific about, that according to the International Energy Agency, Atomic Energy Agency, according to its inspectors, according to the European Union, according to most Western powers, Iran has stood by the terms of that nuclear deal, in terms of which it opened up its nuclear activities to international inspection in return for an ending of sanctions against Iran. Now, that was basically brushed away by President Trump by refusing to continue to certify the agreement. Now, you did mention that Tillerson acknowledged that there have been verification that Iran has stuck to its end of the deal. In fact, so did President Trump twice at the beginning of his administration, signed off on an ongoing 6-month extension of recognizing that deal. It was the third time that he was supposed to sign that President Trump basically threw the deal off the table in complete contravention of international law on which this deal is based, which specifically forbids any unilateral pullout from the deal by any individual party. So that is an ongoing argument. That's an ongoing discussion. In the absence of the United States, the other partners to that deal have continued to explore ways in which to circumvent sanctions to allow Iran to benefit from that deal, which was the whole point in the first place when President Obama was one of the signatories to the deal. But the issue is that the whole relationship with Saudi Arabia is couched in terms, by the Trump administration, of opposition to Iran. You had Rex Tillerson, as you correctly say, express his own concerns about moving away from the Iran deal, about throwing in all support for Saudi Arabia. Well, he went. He was replaced with Mike Pompeo, very much anti-Iran, very much a supporter of pushing them out into the cold. You have now as National Security Advisor John Bolton, who has made a career out of bashing Iran, right, and out of finding ways in which to undercut that particular administration. Now, all of this has come together, and in the end, the Trump administration is using Iran as the bogeyman to justify its ongoing support for Saudi Arabia, implying that if they did not support Saudi Arabia in their opposition to Iran, then Iran would spread its influence within the Middle East. So all of these things come together in terms of ongoing support for Saudi Arabia, but many observers believe that behind that support lies not necessarily national principle or U.S. interests. It may very well be just simple, naked greed in terms of turning profit out of Saudi Arabia oil, or turning profit out of the sale of nuclear technology by people who have close connections to the Trump administration, including, one must point out, his close advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has been at the entire center, without any office whatsoever, apart from that given to him by his father-in-law, of ongoing relations with Saudi Arabia and in directing U.S. policy in the whole Middle East region.
In the last couple of minutes, though, I have two. I'll start small and then go larger, because also this fits into, an alliance, obviously, with Israel. Now, of course, the United States has always, throughout every administration, favored Israel. That's an objective comment. But there's also been still, at least, at the very least, discourse, and in the second half of the second term of the Obama administration, a little bit of actual expression of annoyance about the fact that Israel continues to maintain the occupation and that there isn't any steps from Israeli leadership on the so-called two-state solution. Now, obviously, the Trump administration has gone to a whole other degree and basically formalized with Netanyahu an extreme far-right axis between the United States and Israel, and also built on a lot of shared commonalities of, you know, anti-Muslim extremism and xenophobia and so on. How does the formalization over Twitter of the occupation of the Golan Heights fit into this? And by the way, could you also explain what the Golan Heights are?
Yes, well, the Golan Heights are part of land that were conquered or occupied by Israel during a war against the Lebanese. Israel subsequently annexed that particular strip of land, something that is not recognized in international law. International law very clearly declares that land taken by force cannot be legally annexed by any nation, that it is an abrogation of any other nation's sovereignty. Now, the U.S. or the Trump administration, in terms of recognizing Israel's illegal occupation of the Golan Heights and recognizing its claim to annexation, is completely reversing its position, for example, on Crimea. The United States, Trump appointed U.S. U.N. ambassador, has argued very strongly within the United Nations, where I now sit, that Russia's occupation of Crimea and subsequent annexation is illegal in terms of international law, pointing out the well-known international legal principle and UN resolution that territory taken by force cannot be subject to annexation. Yet when it comes to Israel and the Golan Heights, we've got a sudden reversal on that. So there's a complete inconsistency, in fact, laughable inconsistency with that particular opinion. Now, the timing of that particular move by the Trump administration, there is no real need for the Trump administration to recognize Israel's claims to sovereignty in the Golan Heights. Everything was going along fine as far as Israel was concerned, as far as the Lebanese were concerned, even perhaps quietly as far as the Syrians were concerned. Israel was in control there. Nobody but Israel acknowledged the sovereignty over it. But Trump, by actually recognizing that claim to sovereignty, has now thrown an entire new ball into the mix. Now, what would be the reason for that? There would appear to be only one reason, and that is to bolster Benjamin Netanyahu in the Israeli elections taking place this month. It was a very powerful bone to throw to Netanyahu, who's having his own problems within the Israel electorate concerning mass corruption within his administration and that of his family. But by President Trump offering this particular recognition is a massive boost to Benjamin Netanyahu in the Israeli elections, just as the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital was a massive boost for Benjamin Netanyahu. So you have here a situation, and just to digress slightly, I was present at the IPAC conference, that is the Israeli lobbying group within the United States, and spoke to a number of people who were deeply disturbed about what they saw as unwarranted U.S. interference in the Israeli election process, seeing Donald Trump's massive and very public support for Benjamin Netanyahu as being interference in Israel's internal affairs. I also heard at that particular conference a number of speakers saying that IPAC, that massive lobbying group, has always, publicly at least, prided itself on its bipartisan nature. It has gone out of its way to support neither Republican nor Democrat, but to lobby all equally. Many within IPAC feel that that is moving away with the Trump administration, that IPAC, through its association with those who it is lobbying, and through President Trump's action, is being seen increasingly as a partisan organization, there for the benefit of Republican administrations, which long-term would be exceedingly detrimental to the interests of IPAC within the United States. So there are many wheels within wheels here, and once again the question is asked, why that unquestioning support of the Trump administration for Israel. As you point out, There isn't a U.S. administration that has not supported Israel. There's not a member of Congress that would publicly denounce that particular support. Although there is a shift in Congress with the shifting demographics that occurred after the midterms, where there are questions being asked among Democrats, for example, not about support for Israel, but about unquestioning support for Israel. That is what is now being questioned more than at any time in the past. But throughout this all, the Trump administration remains fixated on not only supporting Israel, but on doubling down on that particular support. So behind it, some might argue, lies Trump's grand Middle East peace plan, which, to get back to what you were talking about a few minutes ago, does involve Saudi Arabia as a fulcrum that people like Jared Kushner believe they can use to lever a Middle East peace, basically by sidelining the Palestinians and by getting countries like Saudi Arabia to use their influence to bring the rest of the Arab world on board with a deal that President Trump could say would secure a Middle East peace. Just on that particular object, any deal that involves handing Jerusalem over to Israel would produce massive revolutions within the Arab world, whether or not this current Saudi regime attempted to sign off on it or not.
As a final question then, what would it look like if we were to say, you know, so right, so there's this way in which, again, traditional U.S. policy favors essentially an axis between Saudi Arabia and Israel for a variety of reasons and overlooks, of course, a variety of massive human costs generated by both the Israeli and Saudi Arabian governments. Trump has sort of put that on steroids and totally, you know, attempted to reverse the Obama administration's very modest moves to try to sort of cool down and sort of slightly rebalance the Middle East, and then in fact actually pivot to Asia. That was the whole frame of it. And now you see inside the Democratic Party, I think it's both demographic, but I think also, you know, as an example on the progressive side, someone like Bernie Sanders, even in 2016, you know, I think through a combination of his own conviction, he had actually spoken on behalf of Palestinian rights going back to the 80s, but also just in sort of the current political realities that if you're the sort of emergent kind of left in Democratic circles is not going to be comfortable with the type of abuses that you see emanating out of Israel or, you know, obviously Saudi Arabia, that there is a slightly ideological shift. So I guess, you know, and this is a very big picture question, but if a Democrat was to retake the White House in 2020 and perhaps, you know, a more imaginative or progressive one, what would it actually look like in terms of a shift in the beginning of an administration? You know, and obviously I'm asking you as someone who knows this better than anybody else in my or as well as anybody else at the very least in my estimation. So not a, you know, of course not just a, you know, on the first day, you know, invite you know, Norman Finkelstein in for a teach-in or something. But, you know, what would an actual shift look like to really recalibrate this across the board under new leadership?
Well, it would be virtually impossible to recalibrate it over any finite period of time. The amount of destruction that has already been wrought by the Trump administration is incalculable. But it is not only within the U.S. itself. One must remember that one of the only viable peace plans many observers believe that was out there on the table was the Saudi plan from 2001, which is essentially a land for peace deal, which the then Bush administration rejected completely, the Israelis rejected. But it's been lying around for a long period of time. Every now and then somebody picks it up and dusts it off and presents it as a viable option. Now, why I'm mentioning all of this is that by their ongoing negotiations that we do not know anything about with figures like Jared Kushner, with President Trump's ambassador to Israel, both of whom met the Saudi leadership recently, Saudi Arabia itself seems to be going back on the plan that it itself devised all those years ago. So the damage that has been done is not only within the U.S. and in terms of U.S. action with regards to the Middle East, but also in terms of Saudi action within the Middle East. The movement from that Saudi plan at the beginning of the century to where Saudi appears to be sitting now is a massive turnaround. It's a 100-degree repositing. So to try and start this all from scratch, to try and recalibrate, as you put it, involves not only a change of leadership within the United States, but changes of leadership within all those parties who are involved in that ongoing struggle between Israelis and Palestinians. So the recalibration is far more than a domestic change within the United States. It is a regional and, in fact, global reboot in terms of the way this has been played for the last few years of the Trump administration. So it's a massive task, Michael, and why I say it is not something that can be achieved, possibly not within a finite period.
Well, Mike Hanna, if it is achieved, I definitely think your reporting and analysis will help make that happen, just in terms of the sort of direct and shrewd analysis of the issues. Mike Hanna, as always, I appreciate your time immensely, and talk with you soon. Thank you.
Many thanks, Michael. Lovely to talk to you as always.
Take care. And folks, I do recommend, I mean, you can watch Mike Hanna's Al Jazeera reports on YouTube going back years now. I think he left CNN, I think, in 2007. Yes. I mean, if you want to get up to speed on any of these things, even just in 2019, with what's happening at the UN, this Trump-Saudi deal, the Golan Heights, indispensable, well-produced, tight reporting there. Okay, we're going to go to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today, and you can do it for less than a cup of coffee a day. $10 a month for a 5-day-a-week news, analysis, and comedy show. Fun half is, I think, frankly, it's been pretty funny recently.
Yeah, it's been okay.
You think we're falling off?
No, it has been very funny. I heard Brendan was doing some drops yesterday.
Brendan has a sense of the drop game. Brendan definitely.
I actually heard, I didn't watch the whole show yesterday, but I did tune in for a little bit, and I heard the that's a fucking good point.
It was there, yeah. That's kind of my medium, I feel like. Better than me on mic is me behind the board.
That's how I got comfortable too, actually.
Yeah, so you'll get on mic, right? That's how, but you started.
I don't know.
You got to speak through other people. You got to speak through Glenn Beck saying, all of us feel like we're living through a barn fire.
That was how I started to understand Matt's psyche. I was like, what's going on with Matt? And then I started to realize, like, oh, that's
quite
a lot of disturbing drops today.
All of us feel like we're trapped in a barn fire.
Jesus Christ. So that's how you do it. Of course, if you haven't yet, hit subscribe on YouTube. Spread the word. On Tuesday's Michael Brooks Show, Malaika Jabali and I made fun of Beto O'Rourke, explained why Hillary Clinton's misconceptions about Wisconsin are relevant for not only winning 2020, but rebuilding an actual multiracial, labor-oriented building, probably for the first time, a multiracial, labor-oriented left in the United States. Kim Ives, who is the English language editor of Haiti Liberté, came on to talk about, well, ongoing, of course, U.S. interference in Haiti, but also this insane story of these mercenaries, U.S. mercenaries going to Port-au-Prince to try to transfer $100 million out of an escrow account into the president of Haiti's direct account. I think it was how it went. Very sort of vice with substance style story, which is actually a lot of that is very TMBS. There's a lot of like vice with a little bit more vice with Marx in it, kind of.
I'd be interested in the history of mercenaries.
I think that that's an illicit history that we will prepare for patrons.
Because it's such a, like, We should outlaw that shit. And thinking about like all
it's
the
incredible, it is an owl.
Yeah, like the Tiger Swan group that like it used to be.
Tiger Swan was at the Dakota,
at Dakota Access Pipeline.
Yep, the Doppel
and
protest.
It used to be like you could basically try to FOIA the CIA for a lot of this information, but now it's outsourced to like private companies, which makes it entire like
well, Mark,
it's the same
Mark,
shit just
Mark
privatized.
Mark Ames wrote an incredible piece. I forget the name of it, but Mark Ames wrote this really good piece about how Seymour Hersh's first major setback, like he actually, he Seymour Hersh in the late 60s, and said he exposes the My Lai massacre. He's writing these reports on all of these various CIA abuses and interventions, but he went after, I believe it was some type of private law firm that sat at some, you know, some incredibly shady nexus of private power and intelligence services. And they basically, they used the fact that they were in the private sector to threaten to bleed the New York Times dry to the point where the story became like a nothing burger story because it was so managed. And now when you amplify that times a gazillion in the privatized world we're in, you know, yeah, there's no doubt about that. So that was what we covered on Tuesday. This Sunday, strategy for the left. We're talking about that for patrons. But we also covered the African National Congress and a whole bunch of other things. If you haven't checked it out, you're really sleeping on it. Something that I think at this point we're very proud of. Patreon.com/TMBS. Patreon.com/TMBS. Also, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. I just want to say really quickly, too. I don't always say this, but subscribe to the Bomb Feed for Woke Bros with Waz and I. It's a really good show, and if you're interested in this world, which I think you should be, the show we just did with Trey from Count the Dings on Nipsey Hussle is actually really powerful and I think super relevant because he was, in and of itself, a very interesting and important artist, but there's also a lot to understand about Los Angeles that you should know. And Trey helped lead us through it, and it was an incredible interview, and I would go subscribe to the Bomb Feed and listen to all Woke Bros as well. Matt, Literary Hangover.
For patrons, actually, later this afternoon, I'm putting up the Oscar Wilde episode, The Soul of Man Under Socialism. Sweet. Was Oscar Wilde a sort of proto fully automated luxury space communist? Well, you got the gay part, definitely.
Oh, right. I was gonna say one part down.
But it turns out he was actually pro, like, machinery will do some of this drudgery stuff. And we sort of go into his inspirations. There's the arts and crafts movement. Have you heard of that?
Mm-mm.
It's like this sort of like communist, these Victorian sort of like, William Morris made a process for making wallpaper, but he was also like a sort of early socialist anarchist, like friends with Kropotkin and that sort of stuff. And Wilde was sort of milling around all these sorts of guys, going to their socialist lectures in the 1880s and stuff like that. So we get into Wilde, the genuine sort of anarcho-socialist of around the turn of the century.
Fascinating. Don't sleep on Literary Hangover. Check out The Antifada. Of course, that's Jamie's show.
Also, there's, I don't know if we don't, maybe not linked to it, but there's like Hill of Roses or some, there's some, if you find it on Twitter, we'll probably retweet it, but there's there's a March Madness bracket going on, so we might need some of your support on that. So check out our respective Twitter feeds.
Vote TMBS.
Yeah, MR's fine.
Vote insurgency. All right, folks, we will see you in the fun half.